Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Total Soccer Show and our latest foray into the listener questions mailbag. On today's show, we're looking at Hoppy to Hibs, Taylor Booth's impending world domination, the USWNT's road to the World Cup, and much, much more. My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me today, it's our Celtic Crusader, who eats challenging soccer questions for breakfast, Graham Ruthven. I can't speak. Hello.
Hello, Ryan Bailey. Yes, I also eat Lucky Charms for breakfast, as I think you guys learned living with me for 2 weeks in Brooklyn. Mm. But yes, also challenging soccer questions too.
Excellent. Can you get hold of Lucky Charms in your homeland?
You can get them imported. That sounds like quite the process, but Tesco have an imported aisle, so that makes that easy. I used to think they were really expensive until I bought a box of Lucky Charms in Brooklyn, and they were $7, which is pretty much the price of the imported box here. So, yeah, maybe the same price here in the US.
I bet they'd be a bit cheaper in like a Midwest Walmart, though, to be fair, than over Brooklyn, Graham.
You paid like $30 for a sandwich as well. Do you remember that shop when you're walking back from playing fives or playing
yes.
football? That was a very expensive shop.
Oh, you're right. You're right, little bodega. Yeah, yeah. Those were the days. Oh, Brooklyn, fun times. I'll tell you who's joining us today, Graham. A man who was in Brooklyn Willis, who is thoughtfully considering listener questions, much more thoughtfully than Todd Bowley spends his time unthoughtfully throwing money at his own problems. Joe Lowry, hello.
If that wasn't the case, Ryan, I don't deserve to be on this show. I don't think any of us would deserve to be on this show if we weren't approaching it at least a little bit more thoughtfully than Todd Bowley. To loop it back around, that place almost felt like more than a bodega. I feel like I'm opening myself up to shots here because I don't fully know what qualifies and what doesn't. But that place was like unreasonably swanky. They had a lot of really nice looking things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there was a reason why I passed on snagging anything because the sandwiches did look like they were about to cost $30.
Nobody tell the Cooligans that we're talking about this, or Alexis will be in our mentions immediately after this is published, telling us what is a bodega and what isn't a bodega.
Yeah, let's move on swiftly, shall we? No Taylor Rock quote on this show, by the way. Emergency daddy daycare has come into action for Big T. But us three will be handling the listener questions mailbag today. Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show, by the way. If you haven't signed up to our Patreon, please do so. We would love it if you were able to support us in that manner. Lots of bonus episodes on there, bonus videos, banter, a Discord. What's not to love on our Patreon?
I'm going to do a walk around of Ibrox tomorrow, where
Malik
Tillman is all of a sudden a world beater again for Rangers, so I'll go and see where he is performing his magic. Yeah, I did one for Celtic Park, if people saw that, so subscribe to the Patreon. I'll do one of Ibrox tomorrow.
Tell you what, Graham, I'll do one of the Stadio Olimpico on Saturday, because that's where I'm going to watch the soccers. There we go.
Enticing.
Bonus content on the Patreon coming on. And Graham's walking tours are very much a highlight of the Patreon,
they are.
Listener.
Very good.
That sounds like a very middle-aged thing to say, but...
Graham's walking tours.
There's something about it being Graham's walking tours as well. The name
absolutely.
Fits very well.
Absolutely. Oh, man.
Much more riveting than it sounds from that description, I promise you, listener. Anywho, plenty of listener questions in the mailbag. TotalSoccerShow.com/questions if you want to send us one. We do love it when you do so. One that I didn't put on our shared document, gents, from Demetrius Osborne, who said, does Ryan hate Brentford for recalling Paris Mbeumo from his loan at AS Wimbledon and immediately turning around and loaning him to a fake club that doesn't exist? Yes, we didn't cover this on our transfer episode.
Wait, no, they didn't. They didn't, did they?
So Paris basically got injured and he got recalled by Brentford, his parent club.
Mm.
And then the very next day, he went to MK Dons.
Oh, no. That should be illegal. That's even worse than what Dundee United did to Stirling Albion yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's. I do know how I feel about it. I feel very bad about it, but I don't know how the player feels about it. Obviously, it's just he's stepped up a league technically, so good,
Ryan,
for him.
I have a question for you. I understand that Wimbledon fans hate MK Dons, right? That makes a lot of sense to me. Does it go the other way around? Like, is he going to get roasted by MK Dons fans because he came from Wimbledon, or is that all going to be fine?
No, they're dirty pond scum. They know what they are. They don't. It doesn't go the other way.
Right, naturally. Okay.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, Brentford signed Romeo Beckham, so there was only so much quality they could have within their squad at any given time, and so they had to get rid of him on loan. I think that was the reason why.
That's true. That's true. But to answer the question that Demetrius poses, I don't hate Brentford because they actually have a solid pipeline of players that they loan to AC Wimbledon. We've got a good relationship with them. Whether that player decides he wants to step up and be loaned to the worst city in the world is his own choice, I suppose.
Just really does not hold back, does
Shots it? Shots left and right. Let's go.
What do you expect? This isn't a normal rivalry.
This is what I expect.
This is not a normal soccer rivalry that I'm describing here. This is...
This is how Columbus fans feel about Austin.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
San Jose fans feel about Houston, maybe. I don't know. I don't know if they actually care or not, but...
Yeah, anyway, I've got myself all riled up for a list of questions. Perfect one to start with. Let's go for a bit more of a universal theme from Kenneth Seiden. On a scale of 1 to 10, how excited should I be with Taylor Booth's impressive season? Joseph Lowry, Taylor Booth, a Utah native, started with RSL, into the Bayern youth setup, and now in Holland with Utrecht. What do we make of Mr. Booth?
I kind of wish Taylor was here because I think he would have given a higher number right off the bat. As much as I love Taylor
10.
Booth and Graham. Graham was there. There it is. Thank you, Graham. Thank you, Ryan. You know, Graham was there with Taylor and I earlier this week when we talked about Taylor Booth on Tuesday. I'm giving him a 6 out of 10. People know I'm a fan of Taylor Booth. I'm giving the excitement around him a 6 out of 10. People know I'm a fan of his game because I talked about it. Just reference that. He's been very good at times this season, but I just want to see more of it. And that's kind of where Taylor got us to on Tuesday, is he's playing very well right now. He was exceptional against AZ over the weekend in a 5-5 draw, which was just a wild game. Got an assist, contributed to a couple of other goals, just generally looked decisive, aggressive, and creative on the ball, all the ifs on the ball, and that's what we like to see. I just want to see it again, and I want to see it again. And then I probably want to see it for a club that's not Utrecht. At this point, for the U.S. men's national team, it's going to take a lot for a player to break in. It's not going to be impossible. And by break in, I mean break in like to the core group of players that you could reasonably expect to play Mexico in a Nations League final, or, you know, Uruguay in the Copa America, whatever it is, right? It's going to take a lot to get those players past Pulisic and Weah and Aronson and McKenney and Reyna and Musa and Adam, all of those players. It's going to take a decent amount to climb over them in the ladder. So I don't think Taylor Booth has done that, which is why it's not really a higher number for me. But I am really encouraged by his game, and I do think we should be getting a look at him in March with the US.
Yeah. I love the attacking intent he has when he's dribbling, and there are flicks and tricks in there, but it always feels like they have a purpose. And so I have him at a 7 out of 10, and I've bumped him up a point from 6 to 7 just because I look at how he could potentially fit into that group for the US, and it does feel like he could bring something a little bit different. The US don't really have a mini Messi of sorts who can actually dribble past two or three players and open up space. And Taylor Booth, maybe he's not that player right now, but he could be that player. There's plenty to like about him. Joe covered a lot of it. He likes to play in the half space. He clearly has excellent technical ability. I think he looks a bit more physical this season as opposed to when I've seen him play for the US youth teams, or when I went back and watched him in some of those U19, U18 games, which is natural given he's a little bit older now. And he's just fun to watch. So I certainly agree with Joe. I just want to see more of this from him. I want to see him replicate this form over a full season. And then I've read some reports that Utrecht are preparing to lose him in the summer, and there are some big clubs are interested in him. I want to see that next step. It's similar to, I mean, look, very different players, but similar to Luca Della Torre last season, where he was doing it for a lower quality team in the Eredivisie, and I wanted to see him move to one of the big five leagues. He did that. He's now at Celta Vigo. He's just about starting to show his quality for them, and I want to see it similar from Taylor Booth. And if he were to do that, that's when you start to get into the 8s and 9s for excitement terms.
So Graham, I was going to ask you, what is the next step, right? So you mentioned big five leagues. Would you prefer that for Taylor Booth over a better Eredivisie team? I mean, Utrecht aren't a bad team. They're sitting in seventh right now in the Eredivisie, which is a decent spot for them to be in. But do you want to see him go to another league, or would just climbing up in that league be good enough?
I'd rather see him go to one of the big five leagues, specifically really one of the big four leagues if I'm eliminating France from contention. As well, obviously, there's an appeal to him going to, I mean, Ajax at the moment are fourth or fifth in Eredivisie, so maybe they're not in the Champions League next season. But whether that's Feyenoord or PSV, one of the bigger Dutch teams that are in the Champions League, obviously, there's an appeal to him testing himself against the highest calibre of opposition. But we mentioned this with Wes McKennie going to Leeds United. You only get a handful of games in the Champions League. And actually, when you're assessing a young player, I think you want the biggest sample size possible. And so I would prefer 38 games in La Liga or 38 games in the Premier League to him staying in the Eredivisie and playing six games in the Champions League for Feyenoord or for PSV. So I would like him to go to the best quality league possible, and that's when we can really... Because that's where the US, if we're talking about the US making the semi-finals in 26, which is the stated aim of Berhalter, I don't know if he's sticking around or not, but that is the aim that he's set, that's the benchmark he's set. You need players at a young age performing in the big five leagues, so if Taylor Booth is really one of the most exciting American talents, that's where he needs to be.
Well, on that note, Graham, 21 years old and not made the full US debut yet, does that suggest a fruitful international career is ahead?
Potentially. I mean, the US is a very young team, and so we're maybe setting unrealistic standards for every player to have broken through by the time they're 18, 19. You know, not every player can be Yunus Musa. 21 in the grand scheme of things is still young, and players develop at different rates, so I'm not too worried about the fact that he hasn't had... I mean, Joe, he hasn't had a call-up, right, to the senior squad at any time?
He's never played, certainly, for the senior national team. I don't believe he's been in any real camp with them either.
Yeah, I'm not too concerned about that. This season, it feels like he's made some genuine strides forward in his development, and if he continues that trajectory, he should be an important player in the next kind of 2 or 3 years.
Good stuff. Most importantly, guys, where does he rank on our Taylor rankings? We've got Rockwell, Booth, Swift, Hawkins.
Durden.
Durden, good one.
Well, Durden's top.
Tyler Durden, surely.
Oh, it's Tyler Durden, of course. This is the war that Taylor was talking about, the Tyler v. Taylor war.
Yeah, it's not so much about ranking the Taylors. I think as far as the Taylors are concerned, it's more about how their squad stacks up against the Tylers. And with another Taylor Booth in the Taylor squad, I think it gets stronger.
Does indeed. Strength in depth. That's what we like to see. Let's go to Ben D. Thank you, Kenneth, for that question. Ben D says, there are concerns about the USWNT's form over the past few years and now leading up to the World Cup, as you've discussed on the podcast. But over the same period, more of the team's frequent starters have been out injured than I can remember in as long as I followed the team, says Ben. Do you think that if the US has 2 to 3 of these key players return from injury in time for the World Cup, that the team's form self-resolves and they become the clear favourites to win again? Or do you think the challenges with form are more systematic than the recent absences of players? Now, Joe, I think having a look around the odds, the USWNT is still favourites for the World Cup from what I could see. So it's not like we're in panic stations too much here, like England, Spain, Germany, France are among the favourites, but US seem to be, certainly with the bookmakers, among the favourites. Also Russia up there, which has surprised me. But what do you make of Ben's question in terms of the situation resolving when fitness comes around?
I don't think it resolves automatically. And by the situation, I basically mean the US not looking as good as they are, looking like less than the sum of their parts, struggling in the attack to really have creative ideas against a disciplined defensive block. We saw that some against Germany. We saw that some against England, and we certainly saw it against Spain at the end of last year in October and in November. So those are some of the problems. The U.S. lost 3 straight games for the first time in almost 3 decades. We're seeing real struggles. I mean, they go out and beat New Zealand twice last month against a New Zealand C team. We're going to see them in the Sheba Leafs Cup against 3 teams in the top 11 of the FIFA rankings in Japan and Brazil and Canada. Those will be much better tests. They're still not any of those teams, in my view, in that group of favorites for the World Cup, Ryan, that you just tossed out there. So that's still only going to tell us so much, but we will learn more about this team. That's kind of the situation to lay the groundwork here. To Ben's point or his question or whichever, I do think that getting some of those starters back helps this team. I don't think that's a hot take. I think the U.S. gets better if Katerina Macario is back in the team, although Alex Morgan is a phenomenal number 9 as well. They're just completely different players. So depending on the opponent, going with one or the other could have real value. Crystal Dunn, we've started to see integrate, get integrated back into the group at left back. She's a phenomenal player, and I think better than any of the other fullbacks really on either side that the U.S. has. So getting her back into the team after the birth of her son is a phenomenal step for this U.S. team and exciting for her as well, I'm sure. Julie Ertz is really the biggest one. So she, I believe, last played for the U.S. at the 2020 Olympics, which was held in 2021, and then had a child and has not come back to soccer since then. I think it's been 18 months. Vlatko hasn't really shared too much. I was on a conference call or press conference really over Zoom with Vlatko and a bunch of other reporters yesterday, and we didn't learn too much about that, but basically time is running out for Julie Ertz to get back into the team if we're going to see her at the World Cup. I would be very surprised. It really does not seem like that's happening. But if Julie Ertz or a Julie Ertz, you know, clone is in this U.S. team, they're better. I mean, Julie Ertz is probably the best defensive midfielder that has the best American defensive midfielder that has ever lived, and maybe the best defensive midfielder that's ever set foot in the United States. She's that good, and she changes games in so many different ways. So yeah, getting Dunn and Ertz and Macario and Tierna Davidson's maybe another of the injured players along with Macario, getting those players back in, and I'd be surprised if we didn't get two or three of them back in before the World Cup starts, that's going to help this team. There's no doubt in my mind that the U.S. is better with those players. I think they turn the U.S. into more than favorites. I think they turn them into clear favorites. I think the odds makers would adjust a little bit and make the odds even better for the U.S. and worse for bettors trying to bet on the U.S. But there are still going to be problems with this team, and maybe I'll talk about that in a second. Maybe I won't. I've done this rant a bunch of different times before. So these U.S. players don't fix everything on the tactical side, but they sure do make the team better.
The problem for the U.S. is that if you look at the top teams they'll be up against at the World Cup this summer, they also have quality players, but they also have head coaches with a real grasp on how to get the best out of them in a team structure. So I do agree that there is a certain point where almost having a certain level of individual quality on the pitch makes such a difference that you can kind of make up for the lack of a good coach, essentially. And I'm not entirely sure that Vlatko at this point is either a good coach or a good fit for this US group of players. But then you look at England, and Serena Wiegmann is the obvious example here, or even Martina Voss-Tecklenburg, who had Germany playing this really coherent and well-coached game at the Euros last summer, and they have players playing for some of the biggest and best teams in European women's soccer. So it feels like the US maybe, they're not at the point of having anything like that right now. And Joe, you mentioned the midfield. We spoke about that a lot in the preview, the live show that we did before the US-England game. And Julie Ertz being missing, and the US having trouble progressing the ball and converting possession into creativity and opportunities. And Vlatko is trying some new things in midfield, tried some new things in midfield in that New Zealand game or the two games, but that's still where a large share of the concern is. And I think that's where you can really see the lack of identity. And it just feels like if this is a generational shift for this group of US players, you look at England and Germany in particular, maybe even Spain. I know they've had some issues with Jorge Vilda and the head coach situation there, but they feel more like a mature side that know what they're all about. They know their identity, and the US aren't at that stage. So if individual quality is going to be enough to get them over the line at the World Cup, it's going to have to be a huge amount of individual quality, and that's where you're looking at getting all the players, Joe, that you mentioned, Macario, Julie Ertz, Christian Press, Tobin Heath, all those people. They all need to be back in the team, really, I think, for the US to be the dominant side of that tournament again.
Yeah, they need all the talent they can get, basically, at this point. And I don't really, the wingers, I don't think we're going to see any new players integrated into that pool. I think Mallory Swanson and Sophia Smith have taken over those two starting spots. And so it's going to be an uphill battle for Tobin Heath to get back in the squad, and same for Kristen Press. But really, the talent is there, right? Like, the number six spot is really the only spot that I'll say, okay, that's a little weak. I think Andy Sullivan is probably the weak link in the team, and that's not really what you want out of your number six, maybe closely followed by the fullback spots. But there's so much talent in this team. The U.S. shouldn't need, and this is kind of my frustration, Graham, and you got at a lot of this. The U.S. shouldn't need Julie Ertz to suddenly look like a real team. They shouldn't need, maybe that's a bit harsh, they shouldn't need Julie Ertz to look like a world beater, right? They shouldn't need Katarina Macario to be able to play every minute of every game to look like this team that is playing really good and effective soccer. And that's been the issue with this U.S. team. They just haven't been playing like a team full of world-class players. They haven't been playing like a team that has 15 of the very best players in the world right now. we just haven't seen them really come together and play like a team that's going to steamroll everyone in their path. Vlatko's been around for long enough that we should have seen that by now. The Olympics was a failure, genuinely. Not because of the result. I'm fine if this U.S. team and any team plays good soccer and loses, right? There's variance in this game. You cannot control everything, and trying to do that is foolish, and I think it's silly from an analysis standpoint. But the Olympics was a failure because the roster was wrong, and it didn't prepare the U.S. for what was coming, and the team didn't play well. They played really bad soccer with the ball in that tournament. That's a problem, and I'm concerned that we're going to see something similar this time around. I'm optimistic that Katarina Macaria will help this U.S. team a decent amount with her play and her ability to drop into midfield. But yeah, getting these players back would help a lot because Vlatko, I'm not convinced, can draw up a game plan, kind of like you said, Graham, where I'm not convinced he can get this team all rowing in the same direction to really get them and actually have them be clear favorites at this tournament.
All right. Thank you very much, guys. Thank you, Ben D, for the question. Many more coming after these short commercial messages.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey folks, this is Taylor from the Total Soccer Show, reminding you that we are inching ever closer to the start of the summer transfer window, which means there are teams that will buy and sell their players early, there are teams that will leave that business very late, and there are teams that will operate in between. But no matter what, it's going to be a chaotic situation. There's going to be offers coming through willy-nilly. There's going to be transactions to be tracked and processed and make sure that enough money is there. There's going to be probably angry clubs calling to complain. There are many things to deal with. And unfortunately for those clubs, there is no sort of business tool that makes things easier, makes transactions simpler, gets the business done efficiently and effectively. But for the small businesses around the globe, there is such a service, Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're auctioning autographed apparel or selling sleek kits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And I really appreciate that about Shopify. No matter how big you are, no matter how fast you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. That's as many countries as we'll be selling players in the transfer window this summer. Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/TSS, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/TSS.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to Listen to Questions. Zach Lippert has been in touch. He says, if Toto Wolff managed Manchester United, and obviously Christian Horner would manage Liverpool, who are the managers or GMs from other sports who could be good soccer managers, either for their leadership abilities or being renowned for understanding tactics? For the help of the listeners who maybe don't know motorsport and also Joseph Lowry. This is a reference to Formula One. So if you've seen Drive to Survive on Netflix, you might know that Toto Wolff is the team principal, basically the manager of the Mercedes F1 team.
Also Ryan's man crush.
Big time.
He is a machine. Have you seen him in the gym?
Also Graham's man crush. All right, we're learning new things every day.
Joe, just for clarity, he's like, is he Austrian or German? I think he's Austrian. I don't know.
I thought he was German, but he might be Austrian. I'm not sure.
I think you're right. He might be German. Either way, he's a big beefcake. He's a billionaire. He's a very powerful man who runs an F1 team. He's basically my hero.
So he should own Manchester United, not manage it. That's what we're learning here. Okay.
Possibly.
He's in business with Jim Ratcliffe, so essentially would be, by extension.
Connected the dots.
So this is the link, Joe. So Jim Ratcliffe, who's linked with the Manchester United job, also owns a piece of the Mercedes F1 team as well. So there is a link there. And Christian Horner, the aforementioned, is the team principal of Red Bull. So
is Zach's question, is that just because he's putting Christian Horner at Man United's rivals? Is that why Horner Bull being... Right, okay. Just because Christian Horner is a giant conservative donor, and I'm not sure that Liverpool with their political, which we'll come on to later on, but with their political alignments, maybe Christian Horner doesn't work well.
Christian
there,
Horner is also a giant donut, but anyway, yeah. I'm a total Wolf fan. So that is what we're saying here. They are good leaders. I think I've mentioned on this podcast before that I believe Toto Wolf could absolutely manage a soccer team, just because I think anyone would run through walls for him. I think he's very tactically minded, very disciplined, and I think the skills he has that's literally made him a billionaire and the team principal of one of the biggest motorsport teams in the world would translate well to soccer. So that's my theory there. Graham, I suppose I'll come to you for your only thoughts. Any other sports people who would be good soccer managers who would translate over?
So obviously, given my fandom, my mind straight away goes to tennis. I know it's not a team sport, but you have coaches in tennis. So Ivan Lendl would surely have the fear factor, I think, to whip a soccer dressing room into shape. So he was one of the best players of his generation, Andy Murray's longtime coach, and he just never shows any emotion. He is a hard taskmaster, so I think get him into Everton and they'll be saved from relegation soon enough. And then just Uncle Tony Nadal as well, because, I mean, look what he did with Rafa. So imagine him as Pedri or Gavi's coach. I think Pedri's coming back for next season. You talk about Toto Wolff being a beefcake. I think if Uncle Tony had Pedri over an off season, he's coming back ripped for that season under his stewardship. But in terms of American sports coaches, I don't really have that knowledge. I mean, I know who... This is where I maybe pass the mic to Joe. He might have a few suggestions here, but...
I've got my own, but thank you.
Steve Kerr is, Doc Rivers, I've heard of him. Bill Belichick, obviously. Sean McVay, I mean, would any of those guys make good soccer coaches? It's just not... I don't have the knowledge base, Joe, to make a judgment on that.
So I don't think any of really who we're saying would probably be good soccer coaches, because I do think there is... a real tactical element here that is important, and without going through the licenses and really knowing what you're talking about, you would have some problems. Ryan's giving me the side eye because he thinks Toto Wolff defies all of what I'm saying. I will say there's that classic Julian Nagelsmann quote that I come back to every single time, which kind of goes against what I'm saying, but also kind of doesn't. He says coaching, 30% of coaching is tactics, 70% is competence, referring to social competence. And I do think there's something to that. It's just hard to be a good manager when you're only working at 70% capacity here. So anyway, some names on that list, Graham, that you just mentioned that are also on mine. I've only got three total, but Steve Kerr, I have as managing Paris Saint-Germain or really any other star-studded team. So good at managing egos with the Golden State Warriors, had Steph Curry and Klay Thompson and Kevin Durant and Draymond Green. Basically, you know, 3¾ superstars, like three players that will be remembered forever, and then Draymond Green, who will also be remembered forever, sort of in a slightly different way, perhaps. But, I mean, that was a difficult job for him to accomplish and to balance all of those. I don't know how challenging the coaching was in a lot of different situations, but managing egos is a big part of trying to manage a super team like PSG or really like a lot of the other big teams around Europe. He also, Steve Kerr, visited Liverpool with the club, has talked about the similarities between soccer and basketball. So there's some wheels turning up there on the soccer side. So Steve Kerr is on my list. Greg Popovich, San Antonio Spurs coach for a long, long time in the NBA.
I've heard of him.
Very successful. Graham has heard of him. Another mark on his resume. Very good. I think you just might be Carlo Ancelotti. I think they might be the same person. Just like Ancelotti is the Italian version and Popovich is the American version when they were plopped down at birth or whatever it is. So I would like to see Popovich coach Real Madrid, and then Bill Belichick to coach the New England Revolution, because he might just be Bruce Arena. Would we even notice that Bruce Arena is gone? I have many questions about this, but I want to see Bill Belichick just switch jobs in Foxborough.
Steve Nash, was he a good basketball coach or no?
No,
or might he be a better soccer coach given his? I mean, he prefers soccer to basketball.
Right? I'm gonna wager not, given the Champions League coverage we saw. But you know, okay. We never know.
Oh boy, I was thinking, Joe, is Belichick like a Mourinho type figure?
Yeah. Oh, I can see a lot of that. Yeah. I can really. So we get Belichick to Roma then, I think is the answer here. Yeah,
that's the answer. There we go. I'll take him for a pizza.
yeah.
You won't. No, you won't.
I have one idea. I mean, it's not another sports person. It's another leader.
Right.
Do you know John Fetterman?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. The Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Philadelphia senator. Sort of, you know, quite atypical for a politician. Dresses like a sports guy. He's a Harvard graduate. He played college football. He's been like lieutenant governor. He's been mayor of his region as well. I think he to me, Graham, seems like he could do like the Sean Dyche role, like no nonsense, but also very smart behind this, you know, behind the ears.
Yeah, but that's the thing, right? With Fetterman, you look at him and you think, well, Burnley or something like that, like Sean Dyche. But you know, he's a smart guy who defies expectations of him, and so maybe just having him at Man City or something like that would be fun. Maybe that actually is who he is. So, yeah, Fetterman at Man City.
Sean Dyche is very smart as well, though, to be fair. I think his gruff exterior hides some soccer genius, does it not?
In a sense, yes. It's like the dark arts, I think. There's genius in the dark arts that Sean Dyche professes. There is actually, just one further beat on this, there is actually one pretty notable example of a coach from another sport moving into soccer. Ryan, you've surely heard of this guy, Clive Woodward, who was the England rugby head coach when they won the World Cup.
Southampton, right?
He went to Southampton and he became their performance director, and then he was their director of football. I don't think it went very well, because that was his only... He didn't go to another club after that. But every so often you do get suggestions of someone from another sport moving into soccer. I'm pretty sure some of the like British cycling people were moved into jobs at the FA or were tipped for jobs at the FA when they were really successful at the Olympics. Not really in coaching jobs, but in kind of front office jobs. I think that maybe a couple went over to the FA. So yeah, it does happen from time to time.
It does. Coming back to your tennis references and Tony Nadal, Rafa's coach. He's his uncle, right?
Yeah.
Because his brother, I believe, played for Barcelona as well. Like his uncle's brother. Yeah. So Nadal has like two uncles who are very good at sports and also has a good football link. Even though he's a Real Madrid fan, Nadal, right?
He is a big Real Madrid fan, yes. That's a little bit weird.
His uncle played for Barcelona.
Yeah, you get that quite often in tennis. So Sebastian Corda, who's currently one of the best young players in the world, he's got two sisters who are like among the best players on the women's golf tour. And his dad is a former professional tennis player as well. So yeah, I think it might just be down to people having money. Whisper it, but I think that might be the secret behind their success.
You might be onto something there, Graham. Although the Nevilles, Gary and Phil, I believe their sister is a professional netball player, or was.
Netball player, and is Gary Neville's sister not the head coach? Is it the head coach of the England netball team, I think? And then maybe like one of his daughters plays for?
I'm
not
sorry,
sure, but there's a netball.
What is netball?
There.
What is netball tennis? I'm really confused here.
It's netball tennis. Netball is basketball, but I believe you there's no dribbling, right, Ryan? That's the difference.
It's in the Olympics, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's similar to basketball, Joe.
Joe, there's no way that you can be lecturing us on cornhole and pickleball and then asking us what netball is, which is a much more orthodox and conventional sport.
I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
Pickleball, by the way, I was watching some professional coverage the other day, and the best description I saw of it is it looks like people warming up for tennis in slow motion.
It does. It really does, actually.
Yeah.
Anyway, I do want to play pickleball. It looks fun. We've gone way off target. Thank you very much, Zach, for that question there. Let's go to Jesse Howe, who has a question for you, Graham Rutherford.
Ooh.
With the announcement of Matthew Hoppe joining Hibernian of Scotland on loan, can you give us a brief synopsis of the club and what are the odds he's actually going to be successful there? Now, Graham, the only thing I know about Hibs is it's either the one that raced our Royco succession did buy or didn't buy. I'm not sure.
I think he buys Hearts, but he's a Hibs fan, right? That was one way around or the other.
Yeah.
Yeah, because what happened was in the UK, the succession is shown on Sky, and then Sky sponsored Hearts for a game, and they put Waystar Royco on the shirt for the game to promote succession, which was really cool. I did enjoy that. Anyway, switching focus to Hibs. Hibs are Scotland's Tottenham Hotspur, essentially. So to Hibs something is to bottle it. You'll hear that quite often, quite Hibsy to Hibs something. And obviously there's comparisons there to how people use the term Spursy to describe something. They are Hibs are a bit of a tragic club. There was this curse in the Scottish Cup that saw Hibs go over 100 years without winning it, which was the longest drought in Scottish football history, and for a club of that size, just completely unacceptable. That ended in 2016, but they still have this knack of taking good players and making absolutely nothing of them. They have an American owner, Ron Gordon, who has spent a lot of money. You can see that in their facilities. They have a really good stadium, they have a great training ground, but they are a terribly run club with a manager their fans aren't really sure of right now. He's been on the verge of the sack recently. In fact, there was an Aberdeen-Hibs game at the weekend, which was called El Sackico because whoever lost that game was going to get sacked. Hibs won, and so it was the Aberdeen manager that got sacked, Jim Goodwin, the very next, or 19 minutes after full time.
It sounds like a wrestling title match or something there. Whoever loses, was it announced on the tannoy before the game?
Essentially, yeah. They gave Hibs a trophy and everything, the El Sackico trophy. But yeah, Hibs not in a great place right now. Their squad is full of players simply not good enough for that level. But other than that, though, things are looking really good for them. Matthew Hoppe, in terms of how he'll do there, I'm not convinced he'll get a great deal of game time. So Kevin Nisbet is Hibs pretty much their only top-level player, I would say, now that they've sold Ryan Porteous. And they tend to use one striker with another player called Eli Yuan on the left as the closest player to him. And I don't think Hoppe has the creativity of Yuan, so I'm not sure where he comes into that team. My guess is that Hibs kind of got Hoppe in because they thought Nisbet would be sold on transfer deadline day. He went down to Millwall to get that deal done and then came back up after seeing what Millwall was like and didn't get that move done. And now Hoppy's there and Nisbet is still at the club. So I really don't have a clue how Hoppe will fit into this Hibs team. That probably isn't a great sign for him, because at this moment in his career, it feels like he just needs to get reps and needs to get game time. And I'm not convinced he's going to get a lot of that at Hibs.
I don't want to fully grill you on the tactics here, Graham, but I want to make sure I understand. So you mentioned Nisbet up top, right, with Yuan sort of closest to him. Is that as a second striker? Is that as a wing? I'm looking on FotMob, and FotMob is always usually wrong in terms of the shapes. Okay, so it's not two wingers and a number nine. It's more so a front two, basically, with then players underneath. Are there still wide midfielders underneath that front two, or what does that look like?
So Hibs this season, and this has been changing a lot this season because they've not been doing well, and so their manager's been scrambling for solutions. But the most common way that they set up is with Nisbet as the one. They then have a defensive midfielder, so it's a 4-1-4-1. And then Yuan kind of has this free role where he, on paper, he'll be out on the left, but he kind of drifts around and he's the one who links the midfield and the attack.
Right,
he's actually not bad. I quite like Eli Yuan. And then they have Aidan McGeady. Some listeners will have heard of him from playing English soccer. He tends to be the right winger. And then Yuan drifting inside creates space for a left back to kind of overlap and keep the width on that side. So within that system, I don't really know what Hoppe is. I don't know what his role is, besides maybe minutes off the bench if they're playing on the counter-attack or something like that.
I mean, the beach, first of all. But besides that, if McGeady, I'm looking him up right now, he's 36. Is there a chance that Hoppe gets minutes out on the right side and really kind of grows into that role and takes that from McGeady, or is that not going to happen?
McGeady is getting on a bit. He's kind of one of their better players, so I guess it would require him to pick up an injury or maybe get fatigued at some point. I wasn't so sure about Hoppe's ability to play on the right. Is that something he is?
I think he can. He's probably better on the left, and I don't know where Matthew Hoppe should play, Graham. This is impossible for me. Yeah, I think maybe he's better on the left, but he could play on the right, I think.
See, that's one of the things with Matthew Hoppe is I think he needs a coach to figure out what kind of player he is, essentially, and he that can't happen without game time. And as I said, Lee Johnson, who's the Hibs manager right now, to be honest, I'm not a fan of his. I'm not convinced he's a very good coach. So both from a game time point of view and also just the coach he's going to be working under, and also just the way Hibs are as a club right now, I'm not so positive on this move.
I don't know who Matthew Hoppe's agent or representation is, but his last, I guess this would be the third move. So going from Schalke to Mallorca, that's one. That was a disaster. Going from Mallorca to Middlesbrough, that's two. That didn't work, although it wasn't all that long. I think it was like 6 months. And then from Middlesbrough to Hibs, which doesn't seem like is a spot where he's really going to get a chance to develop all that much, even though it's the lowest level that he's played at in any of those stops, even dating back to his time in Germany. Like, why is this happening? I don't understand why these are the moves that Matthew Hoppe is making. Granted, I don't think he has a lot of options right now, but still, this feels not good.
He's on loan, right?
Yeah, he's on loan.
Yeah.
He's definitely being punished because to go from Spain to Northern England to Scotland, like, where's he going to go next?
Edinburgh is, I mean, it's not my favorite place, but as if you're a tourist, if Americans love Edinburgh, right? So maybe Matthew Hoppe is going to actually really like Edinburgh. If he's on loan at Hibs, right? So I just had to clarify that in case it was a permanent transfer. There are plenty of clubs in the Scottish Premiership that he could have gone on loan to and got more game time and been a better fit. I mean, he doesn't really need to worry about getting relegated. Motherwell are in a relegation fight right now. Motherwell kind of need a player like Matthew Hoppe. So I would have gone to Motherwell and he would have been a first-team player for them. Yeah, Joe's right. I don't know who's advising him. These are all weird moves.
All right, Jesse, thank you very much for that question. A quick break and a couple more after this. Back shortly.
This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs, who would like to remind you when you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. You don't want to end up with Ryan, Graham, and Joe. Just kidding. Just kidding. Very much just kidding. Because I was very fortunate to have the three of them all join the show. And I had existing relationships with all three of them that allowed me to know that they could handle the amount of work that would be required, that they could be diligent in their tasks and be very effective on mic. And all three of them are. But again, that's because you have the existing relationship. If you don't feel like you have that with potential hires, then LinkedIn is going to make it very, very easy, and they're going to make it feel like you're connected to that person. They have a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire because it gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else. But when you are setting the requirements and making it very specific as to what you're looking for, you can very quickly narrow it down to find the right candidate for that position. Hiring is easy when you have that many candidates, so easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. And LinkedIn is constantly finding ways to make the process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring, and you can too. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/TSS. That's linkedin.com/TSS to post your job for free. Terms and conditions do apply. Thank you very much to LinkedIn for sponsoring today's episode.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back. Shreyas Ramani has been in touch, who says, what are some notable political or religious ties that club teams have around the world? Thinking of examples like St. Pauli or Rangers. There's quite a few examples out there. I've got a few political ones certainly noted down here. Graham, where would you like to start here?
Oh, so I feel like we should go to your adopted homeland for some clubs with political and religious ties. There is one very close. I might leave that one for now. I'm going to go for a club that maybe people aren't that familiar with the political ties that they have. So Livorno in Italy are one of the most political clubs in the world. So a bit of background, the Italian Communist Party was founded in Livorno, and the city's football club, the team, became a symbol of that political identity. And the club was persecuted many times under the Mussolini regime, and their fans have clashed with Lazio fans and fans of other right-wing clubs in Italy. And their fans also wave banners of Che Guevara during games, and they celebrate the birthday of Joseph Stalin. So, yeah, Livorno are certainly a club with a lot of political ties. I think a lot of people know about Lazio. They're worth mentioning as well, but might not be so familiar with Livorno.
Yeah, that's a very good... on the other end of the political ideology scale, as you say, Graham, sits Lazio, who were a favourite of Benito Mussolini. So the club itself officially has no political stance, and I think a lot of fans you talk to will say they're apolitical and they're all sort of... not believe the right-wing leanings that people believe them to have. But historically, they have ultras groups who populate the Curva Nord in the Stadio Olimpico who have neo-fascist political ideologies. Lots of banners have been displayed during games.
Some of them are absolutely shocking. Like, yeah. I'm not even going to say some of the stuff on the banners that I found when I was researching this. It was absolutely horrendous.
Yeah, there's one from a very famous one from 1998, which you can look up, listener. It basically refers to the Holocaust.
Yeah, that's the one.
Which was 50 feet long, which is horrendous. And that was displayed during the Derby della Capitale with Roma. Paolo Di Canio, one of their former famous players, has a Mussolini tattoo. He was shown at the Olimpico doing a Roman salute, which is a salute not that long ago. I mean, even I think it was last season that they have an eagle, which tells you a lot about their leanings, a giant eagle on their badge. And they have a, before games, it's relatively impressive. An eagle flies around the stadium in a loop. And the guy who looks after it was seen doing the Duce salute as well in the stadium. So it's kind of a thing that very much, unfortunately, still exists at Lazio. And if you want to know why, if you ever go to the Stadio Olimpico, have you been, Graham?
No, I haven't, actually. Okay.
Outside on the Foro Italico, which was built by Mussolini, the Foro Italico, which statues. Is where the Italian Open is as well, there is a giant obelisk with Mussolini written on it. You know, after the war, Germany, to its credit, got rid of a lot of the right-wing stuff that they had. Still exists very much in Rome. So
yeah.
it's right there.
You mentioned they play the Italian Open, the tennis tournament there, Ryan, and so that's where I've seen that on TV, because that tournament takes place right in that sort of, in the grounds of the stadium where a lot of the statues are and where that obelisk is, and I believe a lot of the statues as well are quite problematic in this day and age, I think.
Yes, lots of fascist statues on the Foro Italico by the tennis tournament as well. So yeah, it's very much, it's not been disguised in any way, shall we say, in Rome, which is unfortunate. Another one which is quite interesting in terms of politics is Athletic Bilbao as well, which I think we talked about before. You look at the political scale in Spain, Real Madrid closely associated with the regime of General Franco during his reign. Barcelona often on the other end of the scale representing Catalan independence. Athletic very much a symbol of Basque nationalism. Spain is very regional, so you've got the Basque region, all the other Galicia and everything going on in Spain. So different, very different ideologies in different regions. And during Franco's fascist regime, the Basque language itself was banned. Obviously, they have their own language, and as the Catalans do as well. So Athletic, which is the traditional English spelling of Athletic Bilbao, was changed to Atletico, and they weren't even allowed to fly the Basque flag. But as a mark of protest, they kept the Athletic, basically, or a lot of the people did there. And basically, the San Mamés Stadium was a bit of a sanctuary and a platform for the cause of the Basque people. And even today, it's a bit like Liverpool, where the fans, apparently, in great numbers, don't sing the national anthem at, like, big cup games and stuff. So very much a political team there in Bilbao, too. Easy for me to say, Graham.
Yeah, Spanish football is full of interesting stuff like that between the different regions in Catalonia and the Basque Country, and then obviously the capital, and you have a lot of Franco connections there, as you mentioned. So it's one of the reasons I kind of love Spanish football, is all that history. And one day I'm going to do, I've been to a few places in Spain to go to some of the stadiums, but I'm going to do a tour of some of the Spanish clubs one day. So yeah, I'll look forward to that when I do it. I'm going to head to a couple other suggestions. We're going to head to Israel, where of course a lot of political and religious elements tied up in that region, and Beitar Jerusalem are a club with overt right-wing leanings. They don't traditionally allow Muslim Arab players to play for them, and their fans are notorious for their right-wing views and nationalism. And as they see it, right-wing politics are at the heart of the very purpose of the club. That's kind of one and the same, the political ideology and then the club itself. And then on the flip side, Beitar's main rivals are Hapoel Tel Aviv, and they exist on the other end of the political spectrum, and their fans wave flags of Gandhi and Karl Marx, and the words Hapoel actually means the worker, which gives you an idea of where their political beliefs lie. So there are another couple suggestions for you there.
Very nice indeed. Joe, anything to add on to this one?
I don't have a lot more. You guys have gone through a few that were on my list. The only two that I'll mention now are two MLS clubs, Portland and Seattle. Portland Timbers and Seattle Sounders both tend to lean much more towards the left wing in the United States. Portland fans displaying anti-fascist symbols in the supporter section with... this was kind of a big story in MLS with Iron Front and a lot of those.
Right?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. So that was a little bit of a mess in a lot of ways, and Portland had to come out and clarify a bunch of different stuff. But I think there are real ties to that political ideology in a lot of the Pacific Northwest, and certainly sort of with those clubs. There have been different sort of blips along the way, and Portland especially have had a nightmare on the organizational side and on the ownership side, on the thorns and all of the just awful stuff that's happened there. But I think a lot of American soccer teams, right? In soccer in the United States tends to lean towards the left and to have a lot of those same common thoughts and ideologies. So Portland and Seattle were the first two that came to mind for me here in the US on that front.
Good additions there. One additional one we should mention, of course, in England, MK Dons, who stand for the political ideology of being absolute garbage people and the religion of Satanism. So thank you very much, Shreyas, for that question. One final one from Sean Lopez. Who would win in a game between a team made up of 11 strikers and another team made up of 11 centre-backs? For comparison's sake, let's use the USMNT player pool to build your rosters. Good luck finding 11 strikers in these teams, guys.
You can find 11, just not 11 good ones, Ryan. That's the problem.
Yeah, I'm tempted to... In the overall oeuvre of this question, Joe, I'm tempted to say strikers, but is it that simple to say the strikers would win?
I think it is. So my gut answer was striker before we started, and after I made my teams, maybe this is just the U.S. pool talking, but it became very clear that striker was still the answer, despite I think center back being
Wait, did you actually make a team? Was that made to do that?
No, oh, right, you're fine. Okay. I got it. I just made it for fun because I'm a sicko. So my gut answer was striker. I feel like, and this is what I wrote down before I went through and made my team and kind of proved myself right, at least in my own head. So maybe this is just me, but I think the average striker can play more positions and be more comfortable in more areas of the field than the average center back. I think the striker spot and strikers can translate over to the wing better than a center back could. They can translate better to an attacking midfield spot than a center back. They can translate better, I think, maybe even to the number eight spots than a center back could. And then maybe even fullback. I think fullbacks could be done by both strikers and center backs. And then center backs are probably better as a six. But I think overall, the striker can do more things than the center back can on the average basis. So my team, I'm going to go through my team. And you guys can tell me who would win. Graham, I'm curious on your thoughts especially. So for the U.S., my striker 11. Buckle up, people. I have Jeremy Abobase. I have Jeremy Abobase in goal. This is a nightmare for the U.S. I have Jossy Zardes at right back because he's played right back in professional games before, back when he was with the LA Galaxy. I love my center back pairing. I've got Josie Altidore and Daryl DK knocking it around in the middle of the back line. I feel really good about that, actually. I've got Josh Sargent at left back because he has also played outside back for Norwich. So I feel like that works pretty well. I don't love my six. I've got Brandon Vasquez at the six. I'm not convinced that's the right move, but it's what we're going for now, and he's going to muscle some dudes off the ball. I have Florin Balogun with my wishful thinking as a number eight. I feel like it could work. I think he could go box to box and sort of get on the ball and progress. So I've got Balogun as the number eight. I've got
Jesus
Herrera. You're
assuming that he is going to accept the call.
Yes, yes, I am, Graham. Yes, I'm assuming that after a hat trick yesterday in Ligue 1. He is tearing it up right now in Europe. So I don't feel great about it. But I've got Ferreira as my number 10. He's literally played the 10 before. He's a good fit for that spot. I've got Haji Wright on the left, Ricardo Pepi on the right, both kind of lanky, like the slash and get him behind. And then I have Jordan Pefok, Graham's favorite person of all time, as my number 9 because I just can't picture Jordan Pefok doing anything else. I actually kind of like that team. I feel like there are some things about it that would work. They would not win many games, but they would win against my center back 11, which I'll go through more quickly. Walker Zimmerman in goal. He's got that, you know, I'm from the South and I probably have played football, American football before, so I use my hands. That's why I've got him in goal. Aaron Long's played right back. He's on the right side of my defense. Chris Richards is on the left. He's also played fullback. He's on the left side. Eric Palmer Brown, and Cameron Carter-Vickers in the middle of the back line for no other reason than saying EPB and CCV in the middle of the back line is really fun. I've got Tim Ream as my number 6, sort of a Regista kind of dude. Austin Trusty's going box to box as my number 8. John Brooks is my number 10,
like
pulling the strings.
Better.
This team would be more chaotic, but I don't think they're going to be better. John Brooks is the 10. I've got Miles Robinson on the right, Mark McKenzie on the left, and Matt Miazga as my number 9. It really starts to crumble as you get into that forward line. Like, I don't think this team is scoring any goals other than from set pieces. So
are
I'm going with my
scoring
strikers.
Any goals? That's the question.
I think so. I think they could score some goals. And I think with Daryl DK and Josie Altidore in the middle of the back line, they're locking it down too, Graham. So those are my 11s. I like them.
I'm highlighting your midfield battle between Brandon Vasquez and Tim Ream.
This is the stupidest thing we've ever done.
And if I'm picking between those two, I'm taking Tim Ream to be the better fit there. I'm not sure I see Brandon Vasquez as
a
number 6.
No, it's not great.
But
he's a destroyer. He's a destroyer, Graham. Different styles, different ways of interpreting that spot.
Okay, sure.
This is an interesting exercise. I'm wondering how the tactical flow would go, Joe. I mean, you'd have one team who would barely get out of their own half and another who could barely... I'm not sure that backline would have the discipline required.
No, probably not. Yeah, I think looking at the construction here of these teams, I think the center backs would have more control in midfield because they've got John Brooks and Tim Ream, and Austin Trusty's a decent ball-playing center back. They've got those three. Mobility's a real problem for them, though, and I think that's where the strikers really come in. This is so dumb. That's where the strikers really come in. Brandon Vasquez at the six gonna knock some people off the ball. Balogun has some mobility as well. And then Ferreira, you know, gives a lot, lots of energy, lots of running. So I don't know. I guess it could really depend on the day and whether a team's really sharp with their passing and whether the strikers can get in there and disrupt some stuff. But I love this question. Seriously, I know I kind of joked about how silly it was, but Sean, the question was great. Me diving into the tactics of it, that was the stupid part. So thank you for this one. It was fun.
Very good. Graham, your thoughts on that? Who wins that game?
Yeah, I think the strikers probably win it. Just generally speaking, they have a higher technical level, I think, more mobile. And I also think maybe strikers, and look, I'm generalizing wildly here, but I think strikers just generally have a bit more tactical awareness than centre-backs. They have to cover more ground, and so the passing sequences they have to be a part of are more complex. And I don't know, I just feel like you could get a bit more tactical versatility from a team full of strikers compared to a team full of centre-backs. But as Joe was going through that team, I was trying to do the numerical equation of his back line seemed very functional because obviously, stating the obvious, there's four positions there, whereas for a striker, you know, you're talking like one or two positions. So from that point of view, you've got four versus one or two in favour of the centre-backs who might actually be comfortable in that team. So maybe it isn't the strikers that win it. Who knows?
It's a very good thought exercise. Oh, wait. No, it's a really dumb one, as Joe said. But
I love it so much.
It's great. Thank you very much, Sean, for that question. Thank you to everybody who has sent in questions for this Listener's Questions episode. We love you very much. One point of order. I think earlier in the show, I said John Fetterman was the senator of Philadelphia. Sorry, Pennsylvania. You're more than Philly. I meant to say Pennsylvania.
I didn't even catch that.
We love you, Scranton. Mm.
This is like Charlie Day when he doesn't know that there's anything outside Philadelphia or outside Pennsylvania. He doesn't know, yeah.
There we go. I probably sounded very dumb, as usual, when I said that. So just wanted to clear that up. But for now, Graham Ruthven, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Ryan Bailey.
Joe Lowry, pleasure as always. Thank you for building those teams. We appreciate that.
Yeah, this was fun, Ryan. Thanks.
It was indeed. Listener, thank you for joining us on this intrepid journey. We'll be back on the feed very shortly, but for now, bye!